First case on calendar this morning is 74270, Archon Court v. District Court, Rader. Note that Justice Perigary is disqualified as to this matter, will not be participating. Justice Hardesty is not available. He has read the briefs and he will listen to the oral argument and will participate in the determination. With that, Mr. Bustos, for the appellants, if you're ready to proceed, please do so. If you wish to reserve rebuttal time, please so state.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Justin Bustos, and I represent the petitioners in this matter. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Petitioners are seeking writ relief from the district court's order compelling them to disclose a confidential settlement agreement that was entered in a different case that involved different claims and involved different defenses. Specifically, the district court has compelled the petitioners in this case to disclose the confidential settlement agreement entered in the Young case. This case presents...
It would be subject to a protective order, though, right?
There is a protective order that we could certainly designate as confidential. That's correct, Your Honor. But as I will explain, the protective order does not provide us with protection that would preserve our confidentiality and privacy interests.
Right, I understand that. But it's not open to the outside world. By virtue of disclosure to Mr. Parsons' client.
That is correct. So the issue in this case has never been decided by this court. And it requires the court to balance two potentially competing interests. On the one hand, there is the strong Nevada public policy that favors the settlement of disputes. And there is no dispute in this case that a rule that improves the chance of keeping a confidential settlement agreement confidential furthers public policy. The competing interest is that is a litigant's sometimes legitimate need to obtain a confidential settlement agreement for potentially admissible purposes in the case. And so that's the balancing that I'll be discussing during my argument today. Our position is that the court should adopt a heightened standard from the normal Rule 26 A and B standard for discovery. And the heightened standard we're asking the court to adopt is that before a confidential settlement agreement can be disclosed, the moving party must make a particularized showing that it's likely to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. And that differs from the normal Rule 26 standard in two respects. There are slight respects, but there are important respects. One, particularization. The court's familiar with that standard. It applies it in various contexts, such as in Rule 9b, with respect to pleading fraud with particularity, and it requires more than simply stating that you were going to, that's likely to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. You have to identify with some particularity what type of evidence you expect to find. And the second is not only that it could be admissible, but that it's likely to lead to admissible evidence.
So counsel, let's go back. That, as you pause there, that's part of the contradiction in terms of admissibility. The confidential settlement agreement normally is not admissible, but it leads, as you, after the little break you had, to potentially admissible evidence. Why is that you phase them together?
Well, the reason it's important with respect to confidentiality is the public policy interest in favor of settlement. And so under the normal discovery standard, when you're seeking to disclose information, you don't necessarily have to identify specifically what information you think you're going to be able to discover as a result of that document. But when you're talking about whether or not it's confidential, in order to protect a party's contractually negotiated right to privacy, you need to be able to articulate with some specificity, we believe that if we're able to obtain this confidential information, this is the type of information we expect to be able to receive. And not only are we going to receive this, but there's at least a likelihood, greater than 50% chance, that something is going to be admissible as a result of that. In this case, as we've articulated in the briefs, Mr. Rader has never identified specifically what information he believes he's going to be able to obtain or how such information is going to be possibly admissible in this case. And we know...
But hasn't he sort of done that? I mean, we're dealing in likelihoods and probabilities, but I'm not sure that this requires Bennett versus Botaro, because I'm not sure even under... the more stringent of the two, which I think is Botaro, we would deem Judge Denton's ruling to be an abuse of discretion that's so intolerable it merits writ relief.
I would respectfully disagree with that, and here's why. So in this case, we know that discovery is closed. It's been closed for more than a year. So what we are really talking about is whether the settlement agreement itself is going to be admissible. And if you look throughout the Mr. Rader's answer, you can see exactly why he wants to use the brief. And this is articulated.
So has that, the admissibility is a separate issue from the discoverability. Why should we be concerned at this point about the admissibility?
I completely agree with you.
As you talked about, it's to lead to other information pertaining to the fact at issue.
Well, when we're talking about, first of all, I completely agree with you that admissibility and discoverability are different standards. But it's important when we're talking about confidential settlement agreements, because once the confidential document itself is disclosed, the harm is complete. And the harm is complete for three reasons. One, parties negotiate a privacy interest. They are able to negotiate amongst themselves that we are able to settle this dispute so that the whole world doesn't know what the dispute is.
The whole world's not going to know the dispute because there's going to be confidentiality associated with that or a protective order associated with that disclosure, correct?
Correct. But the harm still occurs when that document is disclosed to Mr. Rader and his counsel because they are not entitled to it under the party's negotiated terms. That was point number one on why the harm occurs. Point.
So the harm that you're potentially talking about, if the other party objects that it's being leaked out, wouldn't sanctions or some type of motion for sanctions be appropriate? Do we have a confidential?
A motion for sanctions would absolutely be appropriate, but it does not cure the harm. When we're talking about a privately negotiated contract, in this case, confidentiality was a material term to that agreement. This court has stated over and over again that settlement agreements are interpreted just as other contracts are. I believe that's the Mavey Anderson case. And so if you have a material term to a contract that then the court says is no longer enforceable, I think it raises the question of whether or not you even have a valid settlement agreement at that point. Because as stated in Mr. Loudon's affidavit, the Young case would not have settled without the ability to maintain the confidentiality of that settlement.
But isn't this case a little different? I mean, he's positing than the straight run-of-the-mill, you settled with somebody for an injury they sustained as a result of a multi-car pileup. Should the next guy get the amount of the settlement that you settled with one of the plaintiffs for? That's one case. But in this case, as I understand it, and my understanding is obviously limited, but he's saying that the money going to Jung may, or I don't know how you pronounce the name, but that money may demonstrate, may lend heft to his breach of fiduciary duty claims that he's asserting against your client. So it ties to the claim or defense, which is actually the current relevant standard under the federal rules, and it's recommended in our pending rules. So to my mind, I'm not sure how deeply we can examine that. If it were ridiculous, you would reject it on its face. But how far down do you go into that in assessing discoverability as opposed to admissibility? That's the rub for me.
And I certainly understand, Your Honor, but when we're talking about this important confidentiality interest, you have to be able to articulate at the outset, why is my interest in obtaining the information greater than the party's negotiated privacy interest?
Yeah.
And here, this case, I would submit, is not like either of the example you submitted. In our briefs, we've noted the numerous differences between the Young case and the Rader case, which make the settlement agreement of Young completely irrelevant to the issues here. So Mr. Rader stated on pages 19 and 20 of his brief, we are asking for the Young settlement documents because the rest of the shareholders are entitled to be paid according to the same formula Mr. Young was paid for his shares. That's his theory. And then if you take a look at NRS 48.105, this court has stated over and over again that the policy is you cannot admit a settlement document or the information to prove either liability or the amount of the claim.
That's the point. No one's talking about admitting the document at this point. They're just talking about the discoverability. The admissibility fight comes next if there is, in fact, a fight.
I agree, but even under the regular Rule 26 standard, you have to show a reasonable likelihood that it's going to lead to this.
I understand that, but you keep wanting to conflate the two as if they're one and the same. They're not.
Like, apart from the settlement agreement, if they paid one shareholder an extraordinary amount of money to redeem that shareholder's stock and didn't pay the others in the same class, would that not be relevant to a breach of fiduciary duty claim?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. There is no law in any state in this country that a company cannot settle with a shareholder of a disputed claim.
No, but I didn't ask that. I asked whether they paid an extraordinary amount to one shareholder and not to another.
Absolutely, and there may be legitimate reasons to do that. Let's say a shareholder has one share and is claiming $10 in damages. So is a corporation really required to spend thousands of dollars defending that one share claim when they can settle it for less money, even though the company believes that it's not entitled to it?
Right, we're on a different wavelength here.
Okay.
Let's say there's no lawsuit with Mr. Jung, but they decided to give him double the amount for whatever reason. We don't know why. Would that not be relevant to his breach of fiduciary duty claim?
If that was the facts of this case, potentially, Your Honor, and you see that, for example, in the dividend case, if you had awarded dividends to one shareholder, you'd certainly have to award them to all shareholders.
And that's my point. I think that's the horse he's trying to ride here. Mm-hmm. And you're saying as a matter of policy, and this ties to Justice Douglas's point, that shouldn't come in because of the countervailing policy against settlement and it's collateral, and he had reasons to settle with one shareholder because it wasn't frugal or prudent to spend thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars litigating a single guy's claim, so on and so forth. But isn't that ultimately for the judge at trial? He's made some showing of arguable relevance.
But I would disagree with hypothetical is relevant to our case, Your Honor. In this case, we don't have the situation where there's a separate payment made unrelated to a lawsuit. It was a lawsuit that raised different claims and different defenses. And so the harm, I do not mean to conflate the two standards, and maybe I'm not articulating myself clearly, but the harm is threefold. One, you lose your privacy interest. That in and of itself is harm, as stated by the Henshaw Court. Once you lose your privacy, no order of this court can make that information unknown. So you lose your ability to keep it private. Number two, now we have to litigate on a separate path the differences between the Young case and the Rader case. Regardless of whether Judge Denton ultimately finds that information admissible, we would now be required to reopen up discovery, disclose all of the documents that were at issue in the Young case, and be ready to argue in front of Judge Denton the differences between the two cases. That would entirely defeat the benefit we got out of settling the Young case, because now we'd have to have a trial within a trial. And so there is harm that occurs regardless of whether or not the document is deemed admissible or not.
We're at the 3-minute mark. Do any of you have additional questions at this time?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Parsons.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Court, and please the Court. I'm Stephen J. Parsons, bar number 363. I represent the real party in interest. The anomaly of appearing today on this extraordinary writ bears up the truly anomalous nature of writs in Nevada, and that is they're designed to capture and preserve for this Court the ability to control what otherwise might be lost without the availability of some sort of interlocutory process. And I'm sorry that I have to say it quite this way, but I was given, when I came up here, to the curiosity of why the court even set this for hearing. Not that I'm presumptuous, but we've never, ever briefed, been adjudicated, or had any relevance of whether this information will be admissible. The sole issue before the district court that was the subject of the written order was that they compelled the discovery based upon the appellant here, the petitioner here's failure to supplement its discovery and disclose the settlement. One of the things I would hope the court is well aware of is that the core of all six cases is identical, and that is that the petitioners, failed to properly interpret its own certificate of redemption of these preferred shares. There are various garden variety differences between the six cases, but at the core, all of the operative action relates back to Archon's redemption of preferred shares, which was then the subject of suit by different parties from differing perspectives. The real party in interest here is the class of small investors whose individual claims probably are on the average of $10,000 each, but who number 578 and whose claims have been left at the start. We don't know what the Young settlement consists of, but using a maxim that I do in my own practice, when you tell somebody they can't have something that they ordinarily believe they should have, it redoubles their effort. It makes them more intent on wanting to learn. Here, it's not the sanctity of the privacy of the settlement that the petitioner seeks to protect. It's the fact that they have, by their own admission, treated disparately the very members of the identical class. The Jung members, Mr. and Mrs. Jung, were members of our class at the time they settled their claim. And so not only are we entitled to learn what they were settled for, but that will directly impact the rest of the case. It will lead to discovery. Why did you choose to pay those particular shareholders a disparate amount? Why did you believe, as a publicly traded corporation that was in the middle of lawsuit with a class that had been certified, that you could protect what you've done by simply engaging in a contract with that claimant to somehow then preclude the availability of discovery of the other party that's been in litigation with you? I think you have to appreciate that this is a management problem that Judge Denton well balanced when he entered the order. Much of what they complain of is systemic, that somehow that we didn't ask for something when they well know under 26E they had the obligation to timely supplement. They complain it was after discovery was closed, but that was by their choice. They settled the case after discovery was closed in my case, in our case. All of that was well balanced by Judge Denton. And let me dissuade any misstatement to the contrary. It's not only subject to the protection of the confidentiality order. I can't imagine that my co-counsel, me, or our client has any interest in disclosing anything about that until and unless we bring it back before the trial court for its consideration of what to do with it.
Well, Mr. Parsons, what standard should Judge Denton have used in determining whether it should be disclosed?
I know of no heightened responsibility that he had to make any particularized finding. None can be read into the statute. None can be read into the rules. The fact is, with the protective order in place, you have to hear the petitioner say that something deleterious will happen to them upon its disclosure to an adverse party. I believe that's axiomatic, the very reason we want to know it. We want to know what management, which is self-interested, in not paying my client's claims, they benefit.
Well, should there be a heightened standard? I mean, I think that's what the appellants are asking for, that these confidential settlement agreements, which there's a policy interest in their confidentiality and supporting settlements, should there be a particularized showing or a heightened standard to breach those?
Let me give you two different tracks. In this case, no, because it's a publicly traded corporation that's seeking to keep secret its settlement of a virtually similar claim that even in its dissimilarity leads to probative aspects in my case.
So you think in this case it would reach a heightened, it would satisfy a heightened standard as well as the ordinary standard?
That's correct.
Okay.
Now, generally, let me share with you.
So your point is that this case does not present the occasion for us to decide between Bennett and Botaro, because you meet either standard and Judge Denton wisely exercised his discretion. I mean, is that essentially your point? So it doesn't qualify for mandamus on that ground?
It's certainly my argument. I cannot point to the record to say that Judge Denton articulated that standard in his findings. I can, however, assure this court that by this case testing Botaro, for an example, I think is a misapplied opportunity because there are so many subtleties to what's going on here. Candidly, I don't even want to contemplate where this leads as far as admissibility until I see what I get. It may be a non-event. It may well be that the payment is not extraordinary. But if I could re-hypothesize, I think an answer to both of your questions, what happens if one of the management had a claim against the corporation and the corporation quietly went and settled with them and said, for lots of reasons that are secret and private and protected under 48-105, we're going to pay you, the management, an extraordinary amount. And then they would argue that that's protected as being a settlement not subject to scrutiny. I believe it's not too far a stretch to say the similar thing is present here.
It's different than just, it ties to a claim or defense, even under the newer 26B1 relevant standard, which looks a lot like the heightened scrutiny standard. I mean, these are amorphous because you're dealing with something you don't know what it is. But you're linking it up to a claim or defense, and I'm thinking out loud here. Under 26A1, it's not clear to me that under 26B1 that's all Denton applied. I'm not clear what standard he applied.
And I've got to be faithful to the court and explain I don't either. I do know that on his written findings, which he then asked us to create an order, the order that was entered was upon consent of the petitioners, and they did not further object to the terms upon that order being entered, and instead sought this extraordinary writ.
Mr. Parsons, I'd first like to make a comment. You said, why are we setting this for argument? It's up to the chief. The chief sets up on cases, so it's a subjective view of the chief. But
that wasn't a fault finding.
No, but I agree with them. I mean, it wasn't me, but I think we're trying to develop our case law on derivative-related litigation, and this is not derivative, but it kind of comes from that type of litigation to be more like Delaware, you know, develop the case law. And we've had, as you know, a plethora of cases in the last year on these issues. My question is this, is I know you engaged, or Mr. Bustos engaged in a debate with Justice Douglas on the admissibility standard for discovery versus the admissibility standard for trial. Do you believe under our law that if this information were disclosed, it would be admissible at trial, or is it just something only for discovery? What's your take on that?
If I had to make the call today, I would say they are different. I would say that I don't see it. The agreement itself coming in as a basis of probative proof in our case, but it depends on any discovery that we may wish to petition the trial court to allow us to take. In that vein, I well see it being the basis that if it is a disproportionate settlement, that we petition the trial court to redepose the parties and learn why it was they paid the disproportionate amount. Again, they're making arguments in a vacuum that we can't even begin to critique because we don't have any basis for it. They're simply protected by their shield of...
Well, the Youngs, I forget what percentage they own of the preferred shares, but I understand if you're a smaller holder, the claim's not as threatening to the management of the corporation as to somebody that's a larger shareholder. I assume that might have something to do with it. But did they own the same amount of shares as your other clients, or did it vary? Like you said, you got a whole bunch of clients.
It varies.
Is it a large variance? I mean, you said most of them were small, and they had claims of $10,000 or something like that.
I have aggregated them to believe that it is many millions of dollars.
Okay.
But the individual claims are absolutely the use of Rule 23 to aggregate what otherwise may not be financially available to those parties to seek redress, but in the aggregate form a formidable claim against the company. If I may take up just slightly your last point, since we don't know what motivated them to settle Jung, and they come in with the stylized and theorized, there's many reasons, I think we're entitled to learn those reasons. This isn't something where the sanctity of a bargain for settlement agreement with two members of the class I represent is somehow threatening to the sanctity of other settlement agreements throughout the state being either disclosed or then even evidenced under 48-105. These are very special circumstances where no matter the answer the petitioners give, it has proof upon our allegations they breached their duty to our shareholders. They've acknowledged readily in discovery they can't treat shareholders disparately. I believe that to be a given. We've seen differently in their petition, but certainly the parties below, that has been the rule. They cannot treat them disparately. And now all of a sudden, simply by settling the claim, they believe that that gives rise to a defense to the corporation's actions, which aren't even discoverable. In the Wizard of Oz, don't look behind what we did. We did it under 48-105. That's our right. I would suggest to the court that alone is a reason why this is not a good case in which to formulate better rules about the tension between settlements and the disclosure of a publicly traded corporation's actions regarding its fiduciary duties. I'd also point out, if it pleases the court, that part of the dilemma of that is we don't know the admissibility yet because we don't even know what we're arguing.
But the admissibility is not even relevant yet, Mr. Parsons. I mean, I think that I don't think this is that sexy. And I think the reason I think that it's here is because courts are going to be called upon to determine whether they're going to order disclosure of confidential settlements in all kinds of different matters, whether it's a stock matter or PI or whatever, and we have to give guidance to the district courts about what standard to use. And so in this instance, I think that's why it's a matter that should be before this court, and we should be deciding. What standard should the judges right now are probably making that decision as we sit here.
Ms. Justice Stieglitz, I agree entirely with your sentiment. I guess what my curiosity was, I improperly laid my argument. Because admissibility doesn't appear to me to be an issue before the court at all, we've spent an awful lot of time dwelling upon that. When, as the court itself has pointed out to petitioner, their relief is that it's going to be limited to three people. The disclosure will not go beyond the three people. It will be at my peril, my co-counsel's peril, my client's peril, that we make any further disclosures. And to say the harm is then done, well, perhaps I should take that up and agree. The harm will be that what they've done disparately in treating their shareholder, Mr. Young, differently than my shareholders, is perhaps damaging to their interests. That's exactly what they seek to not have discovered. But not only are my clients entitled to that, we're entitled to it within the rubric of how discovery versus admissibility always works. And to somehow claim extraordinarily that this court must intervene because the minute Mr. Parsons find out, we're damaged, belies the whole context of protective orders, discovery versus admissibility, and the management of the litigation by the trial court.
He's uncomfortable being a super discovery commissioner. I know in business court they don't have a discovery commissioner, so that makes it tough. We've got that issue this afternoon on business court. I like the analogy to the Wizard of Oz, and it bothers me that maybe this is a real premature writ that was filed that we should have waited to see about admissibility, because I know that if you don't know what it is, it's very hard to argue that it shouldn't be discovered, and I get uncomfortable. We have a real mix of views on pretrial writs. You know, I always do use the saying that I can't get a shirt laundered in one day in Carson City at Bobby Page, but I can decide a writ on emergency writ in one day, and we have that all the time. And some people have called us writ happy, and some of my colleagues have said that it's important, as Justice Sidgwick says, and Justice Gibbons have said, that we have a dearth of rules on this. But I'm uncomfortable intervening in these cases at this time. I mean, it just to me, it was I would be satisfied to wait to see about admissibility, to let you see what it is, and then talk about whether anything's going to be admissible. But as for discoverability, I get real uncomfortable trying to be a super discovery commissioner. And the record's not full. I mean, Justice Pickering always talks about the record not being very full and complete when we do these pretrial writs. And again, this is not complete because you don't know what is even there. So I have real problems with the petitioner's position in this.
Mr. Parsons, a question they raise, whether or not this will affect future, if we come down a certain way, confidential settlement agreements, parties wanting to enter into settlement. Does this, in your mind, tarnish that, or?
No. In fact, I think it absolutely mobilizes the public policy as it should be. A publicly traded corporation managed by not independent directors who, to avoid the specter of a result in one case, can't just willy-nilly start contracting with other parties to protect that information from disclosure. If I could, simply, the balance is between the sanctity of a privately arranged agreement, but here, the publicly traded corporation that's already in litigation, fending off and treating disparately different shareholders of the same class.
Anything additional?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Bustos.
As you approach, tell me why there shouldn't be transparency, especially with a publicly traded corporation. Complete transparency.
The confidentiality of settlements is a well-respected principle in our judicial system. It allows parties to settle lawsuits that would not otherwise be able to be settled. If we have a rule that allows you to get a sneak peek on what is in the agreement prior to the time you make any showing of relevance or admissibility, it would affect parties' ability to settle lawsuits, especially in cases like this where you have 10 years of litigation, multiple lawsuits, it would be impossible to settle smaller claims to reach repose.
But why do you think Judge Denton erred in this matter? What did he do that was wrong? I mean, he took a look at what he needed to do and did it.
Mr. Parsons acknowledges that it's unlikely the settlement agreement itself is admissible in evidence, and that's the issue. Discovery is closed.
Really not, because he wants to find out how much money changed hands between a publicly traded company and its shareholder as relative to other shareholders who haven't gotten the same benefits. So, I mean, I think he's made either test. That's why I'm concerned this case is really not a good vehicle for us to weigh in on Botero versus Bennett, because he's made either showing.
I certainly understand your point. We respectfully disagree. In this country, no court ever, anywhere, I've researched it, they haven't cited anything, has ever said that when you settle a lawsuit with one shareholder on different claims, you're automatically required to
be. These are the same claims, though.
They are not, Your Honor. Mr. Young had entirely different claims. He had a claim that the breach resulted in damages that were three times as much as the theory that is raised in this case. We had defenses available in Young that are not available in this case. Mr. Young was one of the first shareholders to file a lawsuit in Texas. He had a tolling agreement. We have very strong claims in this case, which will probably ultimately reach this court, regarding statute of limitations, regarding NRS 11500, which could ultimately lead to this case being dismissed. Those defenses were not available in Young. Mr. Young was a very, very small shareholder. He had less than 12,000 shares. The class we're talking about is in excess of 1.4 million shares. So the company's reasons for settling a lawsuit are entirely irrelevant. There is no case, there is no statute that says if you pay one shareholder to settle a disputed lawsuit, you're automatically on the hook for breach of fiduciary duty because you didn't pay other shareholders. That doesn't exist.
But what if they paid him $1 million on a $10 claim? That would be relevant.
I don't believe it would be, Your Honor. It depends on the claims that are raised. It depends on the defenses that are available. It depends on the amount of the lawsuit. It depends on the desire to reach repose, to focus on your business. There are a million considerations that go into whether or not you settle a disputed claim.
Right. By relevant, though, I mean something that is worth discovering and developing all those points you make. That's the problem I have. It's discovery at this point.
That's why we ask for the heightened standard, because we believe just generically stating, well, there's a possibility it could lead to discovery isn't enough. You need to make that particularized showing. This is where we're going with it. This is what we think it will come to.
Ms. Bustos, last word.
Your Honor, having a protective order in place does not prevent the harm we're trying to prevent. The harm occurs upon disclosure itself because the parties lose their confidentiality agreement. We have to litigate a case that was settled, so we lose the benefit of our settlement, and we possibly lose the settlement itself because the material term of that settlement agreement was materiality, which is now unenforceable.
Well, may I ask a follow-up? Doesn't the settlement agreement include a clause? I mean, we don't have the agreement, but normally it would have a clause that says if a court orders you to disclose it, you give notice to the person on the other side and they get to come in and talk about it, but it won't break the settlement agreement. Does the record show whether it has that kind of a clause in it?
I would love to answer that question, but I feel by talking about the contents of the agreement, I would therefore be waiving the confidentiality that would otherwise exist. So I think we have to decide this case based on the record that exists.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fair enough.
And on that, thank you very much. Court thanks both parties for their arguments this morning. It was a pleasure for the court because the arguments were directed at the law, and we always appreciate that. With that, this matter will stand submitted. Our next case is the guardianship of AS. We're going to take a 5-minute recess to reconstitute with Justice Fairgary before that case.